everybody. This is Alex once again with another episode of the EOT Newsflash. This is episode 60. We finally broke through to the other side. Episode 60, are you shuffling or just counting? If you are watching this on YouTube, thank you. And I would like to go ahead and introduce the co-hosts I've got tonight. Directly beneath me this time, we have Mr. Busted Sleeves. Sean, how's it going, buddy?
Good. How are you doing, man?
Doing good, man. I like the mood lighting. It's very... I want to say, like, Inside the Actors Guild with, like, James Lipton. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. Our first week back, I, like, turned lights and adjusted them to make sure it worked. And then this week back, I said, let's just make sure everything's hooked up. And it's been a long weekend, so we're not putting as much effort in.
No, it's all good. The makeup department did not come and visit any of us, clearly.
Yeah, no. I built a new 5-foot-long habitat for my turtle all weekend long. So
you have a turtle?
I've been, like... Yeah, I have a box turtle, like really tiny, but I wanted to give her like all this huge habitat. So it's like
cool. This
massive 5-foot-long tank. I don't do much woodwork, but I like built a second story for her to go up and eat and a ramp and everything. It's pretty cool.
Is there a turtle elevator that she can ascend, or is it more like a ramp?
There's a ramp with steps and railing and stuff, and so she can go up there.
Too.
Well, because I don't want her to jump off the side. Come on now.
Yeah, this is like a full-blown, you know, penthouse loft, man.
I like it.
You gotta have the railing. Rings.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet setup. It's the first time building one, so it's gonna be a little bit more fancy every time I have a holiday, but. Yeah.
So. Did you give it a name like Shangri-La, Turtle-La?
No, I gave it the name of this thing is heavy as hell. Like the tank was, when I bought the tank, I didn't realize how heavy the tank was. And I loaded it up with like rock and dirt and stuff. And I finally had my buddy Matt come over and help me move it. And we like, it was a struggle. It was heavy. I was very surprised.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm sure your turtle appreciates it a lot. I know I would.
When I was halfway finished, she was just crawling around all over the place. And then once it finally got finished, she was so tired from playing in the like partially finished version. She just crawled underneath her log and went to sleep. And I was like, I really want you to use this rail I spent for every building, but okay. That's fine, I guess. Yeah.
All right. Well, this has gone from a magic podcast to a podcast about turtles. So let's see if we can get
turtle,
it.
Turtle and woodworking.
Hey, those are two subjects that don't usually cross together, and I appreciate the fusion.
I do my best.
All right. So to get us back on track, we also have Mr. Justin down there to the my right. Directions are hard. How's it going, Justin?
It's going pretty good. I did not build a turtle shelter today or over the weekend, so I'm doing pretty good.
I don't know. I'd say you have less cool points than Sean does right now.
I mean, I hung out with my girlfriend all weekend and celebrated her birthday, so...
Okay. All right. Sure. All right. So, as I'm sure you, and then of course, if you're listening to this over on MTG Cast, you know, welcome and thank you. You should watch it on YouTube. You can see our smiling faces and our, you know, visceral reactions to things that we talk about. So tonight we are a threesome, not the quartet that we were last week. So we will do our best to entertain you as though we are four people doing the work of three. Couple things to talk about this week. It was kind of a slower news week than it was last week. We had the massive bannings announcement go out last week, which kind of shook the world. But we've got the previous to go over, the banned and restricted Fallout, which is something I don't think a lot of people think about until they get to this point. And also with the clarification of the shuffling rule is now in effect. So we're going to talk about that a little bit and what that means for competitive level play going forward. But first, let's talk about Aether Revolt pre-release. I did not get to play in it. I was in St. Augustine. I did drive by a magic shop. It was called D20, and apparently they buy old magic cards. So that's as close as I got to some magic cards this weekend. But I know Sean and Justin, you guys both played in pre-releases. So Justin, how did your pre-release go over the weekend?
Well, my record was not great. I went 2-2. I opened my packs and I had a fatal push and a Padim, and I was really excited about that. I was like, I'm going to make some blue-black artifacts work here, and the rest of my blue-black was such flaming hot trash that I did not do that. My most playable colors were red, green, and white, but none of those three colors were enough to just do two of those colors in a deck. So got to do the whole three-color sealed deck. It's not where you want to be. And the best part yet is that my only removal was Caught in the Headlights and Skywheeler Shot. The rest was artifact removal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So going 2-2, I'm actually pretty surprised I did that well.
All right, cool. Any notable rares that you got out of your pool?
Let me see here. I mean, I got Kerry Zev, which was pretty sweet.
I do like cards.
Yeah, card does work. Ragavan is amazing. But other than that, the rares didn't really jump out at me too much. I did manage to open up a Renegade Rallier, the green-white uncommon I'm excited about, and the Fatal Push, which is what everyone's excited about. Yeah, so
it's a $5 uncommon already. That is absurd.
Yep. So I'm definitely more happy about my uncommons than my rares.
There you go. Well, congratulations. You did better than I did. So there you go.
Yep.
Now, Sean, you got to play in two pre-releases. You got to play in a solo one and a two-headed giant one. So how did those go for you?
The solo one went pretty well. I went 3-0-1. I ran a very awkward deck compared to what I normally did. My mana curve for my creatures was evenly distributed between two drops and three drops. Nothing more, nothing less. It was only two drops and three drops.
Nice.
but it was really synergistic. It was like green-black tokens. The snake that puts extra tokens on things was insane. Mm-hmm. The three-drop green guy with 3/3 and trample that, like, when it comes in, you get to give an extra counter. When it leaves, you give an extra counter. That thing was pretty cool. Like, I was able to one turn my snake in from a 2/3 to a 6/7 in combat with the 4-mana spell that gives a counter and that gives everything that has a counter.
Oh, God.
And then I was at a board stall against another player. And I had the 3/3 with trample out in play, and the snake in play, but I had no token generation. And then I drew the Bandera, and so I just play the Bandera, and I start moving counters to the Malfister. And at the same time, I have the artifact that you could tap to give something an extra counter, and the animation module. And I was just giving counters to my trampler and making 1/1 servos, and just like. Within like a couple turns, I went from a 3/3 trample to a 13/13 trample and started attacking.
Nice.
It was real sweet. Yeah, synergy was great.
They called it the Abyss.
Yeah, it was better than I expected. I thought the deck was gonna be bad at first, and then two-headed giant. The deck I played in the two-headed giant was pretty weak. It was just like a red green energy. I think I got a little greedy with it. And played the lizard. The one card that's insane in two-headed giant is like the Perilous Foray or Perilous. Let's see, it's Perilous something. It's the 5-mana instant that each opponent sacrifices an artifact creature and a non-artifact creature because that means they're sacking four creatures for 5-mana. So that card was pretty sick. And then flyers were insane. Flyers in this sealed format more than most sealed formats. There's not much reach. There's a decent amount of removal, but there's also like if you go sealed and you get a deck with like 10 flyers, you almost always win.
Yeah,
because we were just constantly playing opponents who were like, "Oh man, these flyers are killing us!" Oh, there's so many flyers, and it's like, yeah, there's a ton of them. They're coming. And so the whole two-headed giant, I would do like 5 damage, and then the flyers would finish the game. So it wasn't my deck wasn't stellar, but I realized how strong flyers are. Flyers are always good, but in this format, especially, really, really good.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's something that you just kind of bring it up to it, a giant in general. I think it's been since, I guess, Battle for Zendikar, we've actually got these two-headed giant pre-releases actually being a thing. Justin, have you had to play any of them yet?
I have not had a chance to do two-headed giant yet.
Okay. So I did one for Shadows of Innistrad, where I got the super sweet attack with both of our teams, and then Flash and Avacyn for the absolute blowout, best thing ever. I think that they're really cool that they're doing this now. So I'm wondering, Sean, do you kind of have the same perspective on that as well?
Yeah, two-headed giants are a really fun method, especially for people who don't play as often or might not be as experienced or might not really care for the competitive scene as much.
Yeah,
because it gives them a chance to go out, and it's normally a lot more casual of an environment. Even it's still about as casual as a pre-release, but it's just a good time to kind of hang out and talk. Most of the opponents are there with somebody else they want to be there with, so it's a good time. And it's really interesting because like as far as reading and evaluating cards, they change a little bit.
Yeah,
because you really like. You're really aggressively looking for cards that says each opponent because those cards normally translate to blowout.
Yeah.
Like there's the creature that whenever he becomes tapped, he deals one to each opponent. And he's a 3/2 for three, and that's really good. There's a red 2/3 in the new set that you can tap him, sack an artifact, and deal 2 damage to each opponent. Mm-hmm. So it becomes like if you have enough artifacts, you're in red. You tap this dude and deal 4 to your opponent. Yeah. And tap him and deal 4 to your opponent. And so the ratio of 4/30 is a more profitable than 2/20.
Yeah.
So it like really rewards watching for cards that say that. So it's a pretty interesting mechanic. There's always the debates of like, do we build 2 decks that can interact? Do we build 1 aggressive deck and 1 finisher, 1 aggressive deck and 1 controlling deck? Mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of varies for pools, but it's interesting to see how people do it differently throughout. And normally your decks are also have the potential to be really cool.
Yeah.
Like in the 2-headed giant, we open promo Crackdown of the Consulate, regular Crackdown of the Consulate, promo Baral, regular Baral. And so like, those weren't the ones we really want to pull multiples of, but the fact that this kind of thing can happen is pretty sweet.
It's 12 packs of each product.
Yes, it's a pre-release. You each get one of the pre-release boxes. You also get the foil promo, and you get the packs, and you get the dice. So you get the whole nine yards, and so it's pretty sweet. But there's just the extra packs and then the ability to like talk with a teammate. You only play one game. It's 60 minutes instead of 50. There's a 3-turn rule instead of a 5-turn rule. So it's like small things that are different, but it's pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I definitely think it's cool. Especially when they started out with Malphite Zendikar and you had the search mechanic where it just said, you should be playing these in 2 different decks. Your opponent should play a spell, and then you should play a spell. They were just putting it out as hard as possible.
Yeah.
I do hope they continue to do not just cards that have each opponent does a thing, but also cards that just have, you know, synergistic mechanics within a multiplayer format like that. I think they're really cool. Yeah,
these two sets didn't have much about, like, team synergy-wise. Because you can't improvise your teammates' artifacts.
Oh, gosh.
Your Revolt is whenever a permanent you control. Right. And Revolt's a permanent you control, not a permanent your team controls. So, like, you don't get those kinds of values. But you do have things where, like, I can attack with my creature, and then you can use it. You can like blink my creature with your spells and things like that to trigger my revolt for me and stuff like that. Yeah. So there's like interactions that you can have, but it's less so than that battle for Zendikar block was.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And like I said, I hope I continue to do that. So
yeah, that'd be sweet.
Yeah, so it definitely sounds like you guys had a lot of fun at the pre-release. Give it a grade rating. Go for it, Justin. Yeah,
I was curious what Sean got for his promos.
Promos were Baral, Crackdown of the Consulate on 2-headed Giant, and Yahini's Expertise on the release day. Yeah, so I like Baral and I like Yahini's Expertise. Not a lot of money. I did get 2 Aether Harvesters in my prize packs after Saturday, which was pretty sweet. But nice. I got a lot of multiples of rares, like, and that happens pretty frequently. I have 3 Crackdown of the Consulate now. I have 2 Baral. I have 2 of the Mythic Lizard. Because I had one in my 2-headed giant, and then my prize support had one. I have 2 Aether Harvesters. Like, it's never like one. It's never like, oh, look at this one good card. It's like, if I open a rare, I better like it, because I'll probably open it more of them in that same stack of packs. It's crazy. Good old Wizards rarity mix-ups to make sure we can't map a box anymore.
Right.
Oh, goodness.
So, was there a card that you guys saw that whether it was in your deck or in another person's deck that just was, that you just thought, wow, this card is absolutely bonkers and just how good this card is?
At least in a limited sense, Padim.
Padim is insane.
Yeah. The lizard that enters and gains a billion energy.
Yeah, the mythic lizard, yeah.
So cards that I saw were good. There were 2 I had tested and I've been arguing with people over for a little while. I've seen Tezzeret be good and he is actually really good. In a deck that doesn't, he's going to be standard playable probably. Mm-hmm. And then I felt like the demon, I've argued with a lot of people over the demon, and I thought the demon, I watched him like crush people, and so he's been really good. And the lizard was surprisingly better. Like, I don't know if it's constructed playable, like if it's something you can build around, but if it is constructed playable, you're playing it to just absolutely slaughter an opponent out of nowhere, so... I don't really know. The expertise cards I felt like were weird. They've been weird in testing, and they've been weird in the pre-release. A little bit less weird in the pre-releases because your curves are a little bit more wonky.
Yeah.
But in there and in the testing, normally you build a deck with a natural curve, and so by the time you get to the expertise card, a lot of times you like don't have the cheaper spell to play because you've curved your hand out. And so a lot of times it's just the spell, with the exception of the green one, which is not a card I normally like, but because it draws you cards, normally it activates itself.
Yeah.
but a lot of the expertise cards so far, if you don't run them for what they do, you don't necessarily run them for the free spell.
Yeah, I was watching, it was a piece I was reading on Reddit, and it was talking about this theory called Sultai deck that can curve green expertise into blue expertise into black expertise to just max value your opponent out of the game, which I thought was kind of a little lofty.
I don't know if you want to curve the blue expertise into the black expertise, because you'll like bounce your creatures, then board wipe the creatures that used to be there. That doesn't make sense.
Oh,
I guess you bounce the bigger guys. Yeah, that's
true.
I did go a little ham investing, hoping this modern expertise deck works. Have you heard about this one?
No.
Paolo wrote an article on Channel Fireball, and Saffron Oliver wrote an article. And yes. It's basically like, so you play expertise, the red one or one of the four drops, and then your free spells are Beck and Call, and you get both sides of it.
Oh, yes.
Or you play Breaking and Entering, and you run Grizzlebrand and Imrakul, and because both the spells are resolved first, if you mill Grizzlebrand or Imrakul before Imrakul shuffles, you get to put it back into play under your control, because you get both sides of the spell. So I invested in a number of Breaking and Enterings just to just to see if this becomes a thing, because it's also like an Azuth Reach deck. It's like a Goryeo's Vengeance deck, but it has like these other elements, and it also can go off really, really fast. Because Paolo's list was running like Simeon Spirit Guide and Mana Dorks, because you have to have a target for the red expertise.
Yeah.
And so he was saying you can like kind of regularly, like there's like a list of like five or six 3-card combinations or 2-card combinations that would allow you to go off on turn two and try to hit an Imrakul or a Grizzlebrand. So it's a matter of how consistently you can hit one of them.
Yeah.
And it goes deeper than the cheese. I just lost my brain. Aetherworks Marvel. There we go. It goes deeper than that.
Right, right. So the potential for that, I was like, well, we're going to buy some of these 50-cent breaking entrings and see what happens. So we're hoping that becomes a thing.
Yeah. So last week it was Jace the Mind Sculptor that Sean's speculating on. Now it's 50-cent bulk fuse rares from Dragon.
Yeah, we don't worry about it. We don't worry about it.
So. I mean, everybody's got their pet projects. He's got Turtle Farms, and now he's got Battle
of the Titans. Yeah, and we still have Paradoxical Outcome. That thing's gonna get broken. There's a lot of things on the horizon. Don't worry about it.
All right. So your financial advice from Sean this week, guys. There you go.
Yeah, is go buy and win a GP with Breaking and Entering so I can make some money back. go forth, my listeners. We need to not look crazy for this investment, because there's a couple stores that are like, who bought 13 copies of Breaking and Entering? Like, don't worry about it.
Secretly, Sean is the MTG Finance, team, where he just buys up all these random cards and buys up them and sets off the market. You know?
The guys who buy out the market? No, those guys do it like with a lot of cleverness. I'm the poor man's version of that, where we're like just hoping to jump on their coattails. Yeah, that's what we do.
So they have like 40 guys each buying 3 copies. You're one guy buying 8,000 copies.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. So Aether Revolt Limited, just from your initial impression, give it a grade ranking right now, guys.
For the pre-release?
Or just the limited in general. Oh, shoot. Uh-oh. I just lost this. Oh, hold on, guys. Hold on. Okay, there we go. Sorry.
All good.
Yeah, I lost. You're good? Yeah, we're good. I the video cut out for a minute, so.
I was about to be afraid.
Technical difficulties. Okay. We're fine. Yeah. So, give it a grade. What do you guys think?
Eight.
Okay, 8.
To be clear,
I would need to play it again, because there's a lot of cards that seem weird and might not be very good. So I'm not sure how often you're gonna get pulls that just are like not phenomenal.
My
gut would say around a 7 is the average, but it has the potential to be insane, but also the potential for you to like pull a lot of stuff you don't want any business with.
Yeah.
So I need to get a little bit more experience with it. The mechanics are really good, Revolt, and Inspiration. Inspiration?
Is it easy to trigger Revolt
improvise?
For you guys?
Improvise. To trigger Revolt, Revolt's really tricky in certain situations. Despite having a two-headed giant seal pool, we didn't have very good ways to trigger Revolt in the 12 packs we got. So we had a lot of revolt cards. We're like, oh, this would be sweet. We just had to hope that we die in combat, because otherwise we had to run this really bad spell just to get value off the triggers.
Right.
And the colors are not very balanced on the revolt triggers either. Like, black's not nearly as good as some of the other colors. Like, you have to run the fourth bridge patrol just so he can kill himself to trigger revolt sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the balance on the ability to activate it is not necessarily there, even though every color has revolt cards.
Yeah.
Because, like, probably the best non-rare revolt card might be the black 3-drop that gives -3/-3 if you had revolt. And he's a 3-drop 3/2. He's phenomenal, but if you can't trigger revolt consistently, he's really awkward.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of the way that I was evaluating them and the way I saw a lot of pros evaluating them is basically saying if the card is good enough to run without revolt, it's good enough to run because revolt just makes it that much better. So that's kind of where I landed on a lot of the cards. So I kind of figured you guys were in the same camp. Cool.
If you happen to get something like a Aether Geode Miner, which I did pull, that was a nifty rare. It wasn't anything I was excited about, but it did its job. Mm-hmm. That will give you free revolt triggers whenever you want.
Yeah.
But beyond that, it's real hard to trigger revolt sometimes.
Well, it's awkward because, so like, Kaladesh was really aggressive. Mm-hmm. Aether Revolt is still fairly aggressive, not quite as much, but it's pretty close. And so a lot of the things that trigger revolt are things that don't do things to the board. It's like renegade maps and stuff, which fix your land for later. And so, like, you want to run some number of these cards that will trigger revolt sometimes, but then you're also possibly getting run over depending on what your opponent has. Yeah. So you have to, like, be really particular about what you do. And then also, like, if you have no revolt card in hand and you have a renegade map, like, you have to decide, well, do I want to miss my fifth land drop and potentially not have a revolt for a while, or do I want to, like save it? Like, it becomes really weird about when you're activating them. Same with, like, the green enchantment. There's a couple really good triggers. Like, the green enchantment's really, really good. Mm-hmm. But if you need it, if you're leaning on it for the mana fixing, but you want to trigger revolt, you become, like, in a really awkward crosshair.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, there's a couple of stores in the area that I'm looking at checking out, and I'm going to hopefully draft the crap out of this set.
Yeah, it's super fun.
I miss Magic. Yeah. Honestly, it's blatantly that's the reason I'm going to do it. But also because Matt, the set looks really sweet to play limited. So, moving on from our pre-release, last week on Monday we had our random banned and restricted update got posted by Wizards. We got in Standard, Emrakul, Slowcoach Copter, and Reflector Mage banned in Standard, and in Modern, Gitaxian Probe and Golgari Grave Troll banned in Modern. We already talked about this at length last week, and so what I want to talk about here is the fallout of those things. And so some of the things we've been seeing is we've been seeing some financial implications. It seems like everybody who gets paid to write Magic content, whether you're Brian Bronduin or Seth Mansfield, or who, I don't care who you are, you thought that you had an opinion to make about these things. And so I think TCG Player in particular had 6 articles dedicated to the banned and restricted update list. I'm like, really? You can't all
that's
have
it?
That. Yeah, and that's only one website. I mean, that's not counting Fireball.
That's partially because of how they run their articles. They're not not a collective. It's like a bunch of independents who like kind of do their thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's all fine and dandy. You know, you have really good insights. Somebody makes another really good point. But 6 freaking articles, and that's including video series and all things like that. You go to YouTube and search banned restricted update, and there's a million videos, probably including ours. We're not helping the problem. We're kind of exacerbating it.
I was going to say, we're going to go over it again as we complain about people going over it again.
Yeah, exactly. This is Magic News is a horribly cyclical environment. That was kind of during the break when I wasn't producing content, I was thinking about, I could talk about Yehane's expertise and talk about how it's super sick and modern, how it's like a budget damnation that curves into Liliana really well. And I jump on YouTube that day and 6 different people have already covered it. I'm like, well, I'm not going to do this again. I will not feed the machine. At least not by myself.
Yeah. But it's okay now.
Every once in a while, there's something that big, though, that needs to be, like...
Yeah.
People... It's big, and so it's going to get a lot of attention. A spoiler, no, you don't want to see... Channel Fireball is not going to write 4 articles over 1 spoiled card in 1 day. They might talk about it across multiple days, but, like, a huge change, like a ban list or a rules change, like, that kind of stuff, is a little bit bigger...
Yeah.
And it's also partially the job of those companies to make sure everybody understands the whole context of what's going on that it's happened. Absolutely. So,
I just think we're in a really kind of funny industry as content creators as far as Magic goes, because nobody has any unique ideas as far as I'm concerned. unless you're Saffron Olive.
It's kind of funny, like, if you think about the perspective, though, like, so banned cards and rules changes are normally stemming from negative situations. Spoilers are stemming from positive situations, and the Magic community and how it works definitely orients to the negative situations. So there's always more content on that side because we are not a positive group.
No, like,
so I mean... It's like, well, obviously we need to produce more of the negative side stories because that's what our people want. And all the rabblers go, it is what we want. Why don't you do it more? And they get real angry about it. So, yeah.
I don't know if you guys do much. And I don't want to plug this guy, but I want to point it out. Like, they talk about negative Magic criticism. There's a channel called Desolator Magic on YouTube. And it's mostly, I want to say that it's mostly satire. I want to say that it's mostly him just being sarcastic about these things, but the guy goes on like 30-minute rants about how busted Standard is and how net deckers are the bane of Magic. I mean, he is hysterical.
Oh, this guy?
Yeah. When you have some free time, go and check out any of his videos. He is hysterically just loud and angry about everything. That's all I'm going to say about him. So, yeah.
Net deck negativity is just the funniest thing in the game. Player goes through a time where they don't net deck normally early in their time playing Magic, and they build their own brews, and they don't read the articles, and they do what they want, and they take a lot of negativity towards the net deckers. And every player goes through this, and every player is a complete jerk about it. Yep. And then most of those players end up looking at lists.
Yeah.
Because they realize, like, there's very few decks that are actually original. They might use different cards, but they're very rarely actually original.
Yeah.
And if you really want to consistently win, we have too much data out there for you to just ignore it. Like, if you want to consistently win, you can't just willingly ignore data. Like, it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's so like it's... me when I cast my first Splinter Twin and won my first Infinite Combo. I just kind of went, "Ooh, that felt good. I'm gonna do some more of this." So at that point, I've been playing one of the like really janky Jeskai brews in Modern. Sometimes you see the lights.
Yeah, I started and I like brewed this white Angel deck in Original Zendikar with like a little bit of blue. I brewed a Bant deck with Rafika the Mini and like Exalted stuff, and then I one day I was like, I just want to see what people are playing online. And so I like net decked Craig Wesco's White Weenie deck, and my opponents are dead on turn four. And I go, this is an option? we could just not even worry about like buying booster packs and seeing what we can make. I could just go onto this website, click add to cart, and spend like $30 on this dude's deck and go win a tournament. Oh, that changes a lot.
Yeah.
And so I'll brew for fun, and then I'll like when it comes to tournament day, we put that away. That's just for me to like stimulate mentally, and then whenever it's tournament day, like I'm gonna go to the people who spend far more time on Magic Online and far more time at tournaments than I have the time to spend, and I'm gonna take what they've known because it's known information. It's like if I'm gonna become an electrical engineer, I'm not gonna go outside with a kite and a string and try to refigure out how electricity works. Like somebody did that for me. Why am I gonna get fried? I'm gonna just get a book.
Yeah,
it's real easy.
Yeah. So. Banned and restricted Fallout.
got disrailed a little.
Magic is cyclical and it's also very tangential at the same time. It is an infinitely occurring rabbit hole. lots of content produced about this nonsense. There's been some financial implications. Golgari Thug is now a $5 uncommon, and I think it's funny that if you pick up, I think it's the Jace versus Vraska dual deck. That alone, no. It's Nimbuzet versus or it's Zet versus Golgari dual deck. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You buy
it has
that,
like one or two.
Yeah, you buy that because it has Life from the Loam, Grave Troll, and Golgari Thug in there. Like you buy that for like the $15 or whatever you can buy now on Amazon, and you made like $40 just buying one box.
Well, Grave Troll plummeted.
Yeah, but it's still like there's you get your MSRP back off of two cards now, and they're uncommons. Sean, you mentioned that we've seen a lot of movement in the Standard world where we're seeing like Aether, Tradewind, Rider, Mega Zord thing. What are that cards called?
Harvester is a very simple word. I don't know why we're Why are we stumbling so hard? Aether Harvester.
Aether Sphere Harvester.
That is a very complicated name. Just Megazord. Gosh.
I understand that words are hard for you, Alex. I'm sorry.
Hey, when you don't get into the standard, it gets really confusing after a while. It's like, why are these creatures driving these cars around? You get confused after a while.
Heart of Kieran dripped and then went back up. Yep. There's been a lot of changes. Ulamog jumped.
Yeah, Ulamog jumped to about a $25 card now because it's now kind of like the go-to Aether Aetherox Marvel card target.
Which, I mean, totally different discussion. Don't think that's true, but totally different discussion. It's a totally different card. Everybody's like, it does a similar thing. Like, no, because you can never cast this. I don't know what you're talking about, similar thing. Get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. There's two diamonds in that thing's mana cost you're never going to hit ever, I don't think.
No, he has no diamonds.
Oh, he doesn't have any. That's right.
Ulamog's just.
You're thinking of Kozilek.
Yeah,
Kozilek does. But Ulamog's just 10 mana.
Yeah.
You're not going to hit 10 mana.
No.
Yeah. 9 on Emrakul was easy enough. 10 on that extra one is just impossible, I guess.
Emrakul was always 7 mana.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because you had Delirium by turn 3, like, so much.
Yeah.
Turn 1 Vessel, turn 2 Crack the Vessel, like, we're out. It's over.
Creature, Planeswalker. Yeah, that card was just unreasonable in general. So, needless to say, there is a lot of crap out there because of the Mana Restricted update. I know that the Mana Restricted already went into effect on Modo last week. So, if you're looking for kind of like that forward-facing metagame before Aether Revolt comes out, that's where you're going to focus your attention on, especially if you're playing Modern a lot recently. And I'm pretty sure that with this next week, we're going to see the full impact of the format with something happening crazy at the next SCG Open, I'm sure.
I'm looking forward to it.
Got to replace those decks somehow, right, Justin?
It's the least anticipating format I've seen in a long time. It's not like a new set or a rotation, because when a new set or rotation happens, you're like, what are the marquee powerful cards in the set? Well, they're banned.
Yeah.
So now it's like, oh, okay. How do we evaluate a set where the top cards in the sets are banned? Like, we have to. That changes a lot. That changes a lot of
things. Yeah.
Your answer is Gideon.
That card is one of the best. Is probably the best card in standard right now.
Yeah.
So Gideon, maybe like Liliana right behind it.
Yeah.
Super glad I've got a playset of both of those cards.
There you go. Yeah. Put all eight in one deck then. That has to be a good deck, right? 4 of each and like 52 lands. Problem solved.
Well, we got like a lot of ways to add counters to them right now.
There you go. Problem.
Yeah.
There's your format, guys. Black white planeswalkers. Super simple. All right. So enough about that. Go on to something much, much more trivial, I think. And it's embarrassing that this is a thing we get to talk about because it's so hysterically embarrassing, essentially. So today we had an update to the what do we want to call it? The shuffle rule for...
The comprehensive rules for shuffling?
Yes. So this is Section 3.9 shuffling. In the previous tournament rules update, we announced rules changing regarding pile shuffling. Based on observation and feedback, we are now restricting pile shuffling to once per game and only at the beginning of that game. Remember, pile shuffling is not sufficient shuffling. It should only be used to count the cards in a deck. So in layman's terms, it used to be you could pile shuffle once at any point in the game before your life total hits zero, or you got 10 poison, or you got milled out. Now it is at the beginning of the game only. And basically what brought this around was there was an incident at a recent tournament where a player who was looking to lock up a high-placing finish basically took every opportunity that they were to shuffle and pile shuffled in addition to doing kind of in mass shuffling or judicial randomization. So this is now in effect for all competitive REL. So what do you guys think about this, and should we even have to worry about this?
I appreciate it. There have been times where I go to a GP or an IQ or a PPTQ and my opponent, like, he shuffles up, draws a 7, doesn't like it, mulligans it away, and then decides, hey, you know, I had 7 lands in my hand, I'm going to pile shuffle now. Which, you know, it's like, by the time we actually start the game, you know, we now have 45 minutes to actually play the game, which can be huge.
Yeah.
I mean, time-wise, though, that doesn't change from if they pile shuffle the beginning. Like, right. Pile shuffling. If I pile shuffle at the beginning, I pile shuffle after I mulligan once. It doesn't change time-wise. The difference is now players can't take additional information to decide to pile shuffle.
Yeah.
So I like it from any concept of further narrowing cheating, which is just like it's dumb to even run into. Mm-hmm. But there's constantly players who are constantly looking for like angles and positions, and you can see their play style changes when they take game one, and game one took a while.
Yeah.
And like I take game one, then I start pile shuffle aggressively game two. So that way, by the time we get to game two, you have 10 minutes for you to win this controlling matchup.
Yeah.
And like that's not healthy for the game. It's dumb that we're in a situation where it has to be said. I don't want them to fully get rid of it, because the main purpose of it is to count your cards. And there are accidents where like everybody's had an accident where a card is dropped. And sometimes you don't notice it drops, and then you like do a pile shuffle and you realize you're short. Mm-hmm. Or you did notice it drops, but you could have very easily not noticed. So the pile shuffle being able to verify that I'm presenting an actual 60 card deck is good. But making it where people can't just do it over and over again is important. Because I mean, even though there's some people who do it real fast, there are people who pile shuffle like two or three times and then present.
Yeah.
And it's like, come on. That's a waste of time. At FNM, it's good to do it, I think, once, like, to make sure your deck is actually accurate. Because there's nothing worse than presenting a deck and losing the game when you haven't even played the game.
Yeah.
Like, present the deck, start playing, judge gets called up and goes, this player presented a 59-card deck, he has a card at his foot. And it's like, oh, that's great. So you don't want that at all, and that's not good for the game either, but narrowing the ability to slow play out is good.
Yeah, and I think it's especially good for newer players, you know, kind of like you were saying, Justin, who are kind of maybe starting out at that local competitive level, like at a GPT or an IQ. When I first started playing, I didn't understand the concept of mass shuffling or riffle shuffling. All I knew was just lay my cards out in piles of, you know, 10 and do six piles, and then I pick those up in a random order and then kind of, you know, cut them once and give it to my opponent. And it wasn't until I got to my very first GP at a side event, my opponent was like, you can't do that. And I had no idea what he's talking about. He calls a judge over and explains the situation. And I guess it was just the absolute bewilderment on my face that said, I had no idea. The judge was like, okay, this is what you need to do. I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. I picked up my deck, riffled it a couple times. I'm like, all right, now we're cool. You know, guy was an ass about it. Whatever.
And on the time thing, while it is true that if they had started their first shuffle when the timer had started, then yes, it would take the same amount of time. But oftentimes, players are able to start the shuffling and drawing of their first seven before the timer started. But generally speaking, the timer has started by the time that people have, decided.
I mean, like, that's semantics, though. Like, yeah, time
I see
is
what he's saying.
Like,
I see what he's saying.
If I sit down in a seat and I pile shuffle now, or I pile shuffle in like 10 minutes, I've set the seat for the same length of time, regardless.
Yeah.
So, but like, what I'm talking about is
like, yeah, you can mulligan, but you can do that beforehand. So like, if I do this first and then I draw, or I draw and then I do it, it's the exact same amount of time. Like, if you time it, it's the exact same amount of time, and the game hasn't started, because you can resolve mulligans before the clock starts as well.
Yeah.
So it would have made a difference either way, time wise. Like, yes, I'm all for restricting when people are doing it, but it doesn't impact the time, like, in any way, shape, or form, because it's still the same amount of time sitting there.
Yeah, like, I can see that. It's
you're like sitting at your seat a different amount.
Yeah, it's literally coming down to seconds, I think. You know, how long does it take you to resolve a mulligan? 15 seconds, usually. So, over the course of a tournament, I can see it having a relatively detrimental effect, but it's going to be such a small percentage of the time that I don't think it becomes relevant after a while.
I think one of the big negatives, though, is I'm all for stopping the cheating, but then you also get the rules ninjas. And, like, I've already multiple times seen people pile shuffling and heard their opponents go, you're not allowed to do that anymore. And it's like, yeah, whoa, slow down. And I've, like, heard people call a judge with the hope of getting somebody a game loss for pile shuffling. And it's like, okay, like, now we're just going to have this other extra element that people are going to try to rules ninja all the time.
Have they explained what the infraction is? Is it a game rule violation? It has to be a game rule violation of some kind. It's possibly just a warning. It's gonna be
a warning. It's not gonna be more than a warning.
It can't be game loss. That's absurd.
It's gonna fall under like the failure to maintain a board state thing, where it's not a big enough thing to warrant a game loss immediately. So it's gonna be a warning, and then they'll, like, if you're constantly doing it, they'll upgrade it. But it'll probably be a warning to start, because it's just another thing. One of my biggest fears in the game is what happens when people learn that they can just bold face a lie, and if nobody else is paying attention, what's going to happen? Like, what happens? Yeah. I sit down across from Alex, and I say, and Alex begins to polish off. I go, okay, you stop for a second. I call a judge over. And when the judge shows up, I talk to him over the table. I say, that's his second time to pile shuffle. Well, who's gonna have your back? Who's been staring at you, watching you pile shuffle?
Exactly, yeah.
So it's got to be a warning-based thing. Because, like, it's one thing if somebody hears me say something combat-wise wrong or do something wrong, like, verbally. But our neighbors next to us are starting their own games. They're not going to know how many times you pile shuffled. Yeah. So if it's more than a warning, that becomes a really dangerous thing.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. Mm-hmm. So I'll be interested to see if this actually becomes a, this almost feels like it's just kind of like a warning across the board. And it might not even be something they actually start enforcing. I don't want to say that they're not going to enforce it, but it's just such a, hey, this is now the going forward standard, and everyone just kind of goes, okay, cool, no problem with that, and nobody actually ever worries about it, just because everyone understands that is the status quo.
I don't remember, Justin, you might remember, I don't think in the last post it actually verbatim said pile shuffling is not a valid form of randomization. I think they said it, but I don't think it was actually in the rules.
Yeah,
so I don't think this was in the rules.
I think this was more an update just to actually put in writing, this is not shuffling.
Yeah.
Just so that way a judge doesn't have to deal with the person who says, like, I've been playing this game since 1990 and this is shuffling fine. And so this way he could just show, like, look, I'm following the rules that I'm given. It says this isn't valid. You know, if you can email Wizards if you feel like it is, but here's what it is. I feel like it's more just like just a clean cut of saying it isn't shuffling, and that's Wizards' stance.
Yeah.
Which is more definitely than a good thing.
Yeah.
Because I was actually taught by a judge when I first started playing Magic to pile shuffle, and that was sufficient randomization. And that's back in 2004. This is, you know, 12 years ago now. Things have changed since. But yeah, you've got all of those people that have been playing forever that maybe not keep up with the rules as well, and probably still think that that's okay for shuffling.
Yeah. See, I don't. The thing is, like, it can be a form of randomization.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you pile and you don't do the same, if, like, so what I do with my deck is I'll rifle it once or twice, then pile, and I'll pick up the piles in different orders every time, and then I'll rifle it multiple more times. And since I'm not keeping track of the cards, it is a randomization because I've randomized this and I'm randomizing the order I picked them up. They're never the same order I'm picking them up. And so it's small. It's not a very effective form, so I do other randomizations. But it's the fact that people are going to use it to cheat that makes it where, like, now me doing it raises a red flag for opponents. And so
absolutely.
Like, but it's still just like, if I draw a million lands, it's just superstition. Like, it's like sports. The game is compared to sports a lot of times in a lot of ways, and it's a superstition thing. Okay, I drew a million lands. Let's break this deck apart because maybe it'll be afraid because I've broken it now, and I'll put it back together and it'll work right. Like, and yeah, that's not a valid form of randomization. It takes me 2 seconds, and I just do it, and I don't know any position of the cards when I do it.
Yeah.
So I'm not a breaking it, but because people are breaking it, it's now, like, taboo.
Yeah. And I don't know if everybody knows, but some people might not be aware of things like called the double nickel, where you take it's 5 piles, I believe, and if you kind of, like, order your deck and then shuffle it and then not have your opponent cut it in any way, you can actually have, like, this theoretically perfect distribution of lands versus spells. So it's things like that people just need to be
aware of. It's ways to be broken. It's sleight of hand we're working in a game that has made magicians famous.
Yeah.
So, like, the ability to manipulate card locations is obviously a thing. Mm-hmm. And so because of that ability, we just have to, and because there's money on the line now, there's this big fear of it. So the nature of playing that game.
Yeah, unfortunately, some people, because, like you said, Sean, there's money on the line, there's qualifications for pro tours, there's status as a pro-ranked player, whether you're gold, silver, or platinum, anything like that, it becomes a game of inches, and unfortunately, sometimes those inches require some rather shady tactics, so.
Yeah.
Overall, I think this is a positive thing. It doesn't feel like a rules change so much as a clarification, and we're all just going to go, okay, let's go on with our lives and keep smashing our bras into each other.
Take a unified stance.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, before we kind of wrap up here tonight, Justin, you had one thing that actually just popped up, I think, on all of our Facebook groups. The registration for GP San Antonio is now live. Is that correct? And there was something kind of suspect that you wanted to bring up real quickly here.
I find it really weird that for the main event only, they don't mention that you get a playmat. But if you spend an extra $45, then you get the three playmats, which do look sweet. They're the Masterpiece, sort of Feast and Famine, Fire and Ice, and Light and Shadow.
How do you decide who gets which one?
Well, each team member registers individually. So the member that decides to spend an extra $45 gets all three. So if all three of you decide, hey, we really want these playmats, that's how.
Okay.
Did they say that you aren't getting mats if you don't pay the $45?
Well, they don't say you're not, but like so the first option that they have is main event plus swag. And it says includes first it says each team member must register individually.
Mm-hmm.
Then it says includes main event entry, exclusive Grand Prix promo, a set of three Ultra Pro Grand Prix San Antonio playmats, and free mini master event must be present Friday at 11 a.m. to redeem. For the main event only, it includes the main event entry, the exclusive Grand Prix foil promo, and the free mini master event with no mention of playmats.
Huh.
So, I mean, maybe they could have just neglected and said, you know, maybe it is you get one if you do the main event, but it's very odd that a GP would make you require to pay extra for the playmats, which is usually like a nifty free thing they throw in.
Yeah, and like a $70 entry fee for just the GP is already absurdly high as it is. I mean,
yeah, they've been getting ridiculous.
It's been a while since I played in a GP, and my last one was in GP Oklahoma City, but that was like $60, $55.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember starting when 5Ks were like $30.
Yeah.
And I want to say Pittsburgh coming up in February, the playmat is not included in the beginning price.
Yeah.
Like your basic entry, you don't get. I want to say that some friends I have going to are saying that the playmat's not included. You have to like pay an upcharge, and then the upcharge gives you the playmat and a sleeping special.
And that's kind of cool. Like paying for sleeping specials is one thing. Paying for playmats though, it's a $45 difference between the swag version versus not. So effectively, like if you can get your buddies to like chip in 15 extra bucks, like then it's not such a problem. But that's kind of crappy.
But, I mean, the pay rates are already just high enough. Like it's dumb that they're jumping it in other ways, and it's actually kind of silly to pay for a sleeping special and not the playmat, because the playmat's actually tangible. A sleeping special is nothing.
Yeah.
It's literally just less people for them to manage. So it's literally just an easier morning for them. So let me pay you money for it.
I think the sleeping special is only worth it unless you're playing a sealed GP, because otherwise you show up for the players meeting and then go to Starbucks for 3 hours. It doesn't matter paying for it for a constructed event is stupid in my opinion.
It kind of depends. Like sometimes it's not bad. Like you want to get some rest before the actual day of, and it all depends on like how your carpooling is going and stuff. But if like you flew to a GP and you flew like the night before, sleeping in isn't a bad idea.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's if they're starting to like phase even more so, because like the entry fees for the Pittsburgh one, like there's regular entry fees, but to get like sleep-in specials and playmats, it gets up close to $100, and it's like that's absurd.
Yeah.
Like.
And I hope
the price they jumped the price support, and so they jumped the entry fee, and everybody's like, that makes sense. The price support went up, but then they continued to jump the entry fee after that. And so it's like, well, okay, so you can't jump once on the price support and then jump three times on the entry fee. Like it's a 1-to-1 ratio. Yeah. Like that's how this works.
And the problem is that when you know, with this opens up a whole other can of worms, but when you have the problem of like, well, who's paying the judges? Who's paying the event staff? Like, there's a whole lot to unpack here and digest. But and without going into that, I think it is negatively affecting the players. You know, the Grand Prix are not like, it's cool to go to a Grand Prix, you know, if you're a pro player. But the Grand Prix to me is something for like local players who it's their one big tournament out of the year to go play in, and that's what they want to go do. And maybe they're not going to do very well. They're going to go have that great experience, but they're going to shell out like almost $80, you know, for a playmat and a promo. And I have a hard time justifying that in the eyes of, you know, your average consumer, I think.
I think the thing that kicks me most is how close constructed and sealed GPs are.
Yeah.
The fact that their entry fees are really, really close tells me, like, all right, so our constructeds, we're being really greedy. Because, like, we're getting an extra 6 booster packs for each player on the sealed. Why is it pretty much the same cost as a constructed?
Yeah.
And so that's – I do feel like the more they've handed out the job of running GPs and they've taken less control of it themselves, the more crazy the prices have gotten.
Yeah, I would hate to think that it's because of, like, this somewhat premium nature of these play mats and the fact that there's 3 different play mats. Like, Sean, can you remember how much GP Nashville was to enter? Wasn't this much. I mean, it's
been it was not. I want to say it was like 50 or 60.
Yeah, and all 3 play mats came in the big paper bag they gave us. Do you remember that?
Yeah, because we also got the triple deck boxes. And, yeah. Like, we got some cool stuff.
The triple deck boxes were extra, I remember.
That's right, yeah. But
they handed out every team a giant brown paper bag, like you put your lunch in, and it had a bazillion boosters in it and 3 play mats, and, you know, it was just like Christmas.
Yeah, and the registration paper, yeah. Like, the prices are climbing, and I wouldn't be... Part of me thinks it might be related to the Judge Wizards battle recently.
Yeah, we're not digging into that, obviously.
Right, but so the judges were saying, like, we're paid by Wizards, and we're just saying, no, we don't run these tournaments. And so I feel like it might come down to, like, since Wizards is trying to be as hands off of the tournament so they don't have to readdress that fight again, that they're also not able to set a price.
Yeah.
They're not able to regulate it. So all these companies that are running the GPs are just, like, inching them higher and higher and higher, trying to increase their profit margins.
And it very well,
because Wizards also isn't supporting the coverage either. So these companies running the GPs are having to do the coverage, having to do the GP, having to ship everything out there. And so they're just like, well, let's make some money off this.
Yeah. Well, I think in particular, certain GPs, Wizards does handle the coverage, unless it's a Channel Fireball or an SCG-run Grand Prix. But I'm hoping that, because obviously you have these companies like Cascade Games, I'm blanking on some of the big trios that are out there. I'm hoping this isn't just the fact of them trying to creep it up to the point where they're actually breaking even at some point. Because these GPs can't be cheap to run when you're factoring event space and everything else that goes along with it. Maybe charging that $50 entry fee, which was, I think, a perfectly reasonable fee for a Grand Prix, is them actually losing money at the end of the day. And then trying to figure out other ways to break even somehow. So I hope this isn't an indicator of that, which then leads into, you know, a decrease of GPs down the line because these companies just can't afford to run them anymore. So
I think they make more money on their side events than on their main events.
I absolutely believe
like,
that.
Absolutely. So, like, if I raise the price, it gets some of the casuals who are going to play the GP to maybe come up and hang out and play the side events where I'm actually going to make money, as opposed to getting more participation in the main event. But...
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely an alarming thing at the rate at which it climbs without the price support constantly seeing a change.
Yeah. I'm already looking ahead to, like, Grand Prix Vegas this year, which hopefully I'll be in attendance of for the first time in forever. I'm already shuddering to think what those prices are going to be like to get into that thing.
Yeah.
On top of getting the rooms and everything else to go along with that, that's going to be a very expensive trip.
That one's still a possible one I might be going to, and it's like... If not, if they keep doing these GP price hikes, not doable.
Yeah. Because I know Sean that you've gone to the last 2, haven't you, or just last year's?
Just last year's.
Yeah, and I know it was a huge. I know, last like, one. James and the guys all went. It was a big party. I unfortunately had to miss it due to work reasons. So this was like the year I was planning on going, and I'm just hoping that enough of us can kind of get together to actually go do this because I can't think of anything cooler than a triple. Grand Prix weekend.
Yeah, it has
definitely
a lot
of value. Exciting.
Oh yeah,
like, if you can do well on Legacy and then do well on Modern and you just end up skipping the limited because you're day doing the Legacy, like the potential value there money wise and pro point wise and planeswalker point wise is really high. But it is, I mean, it is still, I don't like the limited aspect, but hopefully we won't have to play it.
Yeah, if anybody has parts to Legacy Eldrazi to put me tomorrow, I will be very appreciative of that.
I have it. I don't know if it's available.
I'm kind of regretting selling my Ancient Tombs to you now, but hey, it's okay. It's whatever.
Don't worry about it. Yeah.
They've gone back down. It's all right.
Yeah.
All right. So I think that about wraps it up. Before we go down just another rabbit hole of just, you know, conspiracy theories of why Wizards is hiking the prices on the GPs. Yeah. think we're going to wrap it up here. So this weekend is the release of Aether Revolt. We're going to see what happens when Tezzeret unleashes his machinations on Kaladesh and, you know, ruins the format for us again, hopefully, because Tezzeret's awesome. We're going to see if all of these new vehicles are worth a damn. And it's going to be...
Can we discuss one thing? On the next episode, I want us to discuss the GP price hike going to paying for a life-size replica scale of Nicol Bolas as a robot. I feel like that's the only realistic reason they've spiked the price. Is there's going to be a giant Power Ranger-sized robot of Nicol Bolas. This is going
to
happen.
You show me the blueprints. You show me the pre-construction already taking place. I will go to every damn GP for the rest of the year to help realize... Mecha Nicol Bolas that we get to see at like PAX this year when they unveil Amon Cat. I will.
No, they send him to Egypt and he starts destroying the actual pyramids there. And they're like, "This is not worth it."
Hold on, guys. This is a prediction for next year. The World Championship will be held inside the Pyramids of Giza.
I don't think you're getting Team Israel or a lot of other teams to go to Egypt, bro. Like, I don't think that's happening. I don't think that's in the cards. People don't want anything to do with that whole little bottom right corner down there. I mean, that whole area.
I saw a picture on Reddit of a magic shop in Egypt. So they play it over there, apparently. I just don't know how much.
They might play it, but they might not like everybody else that plays it. They don't probably want a lot of us going down there.
That's fair.
No. Oh, pass.
That would have been like holding the Olympics in Germany in the 1940s. It would have been a terrible idea.
Well, okay.
Okay, yeah.
They held a lot of events there, but this isn't a history podcast. A lot of things.
This is a magic current events and nothing else. Yeah. So.
Yeah. We're going to talk about a lot of bad decisions we've made as a race. Just move. Let's talk about the bad decisions we make as a game.
Yeah,
How's that sound?
It. Yeah. It's just... Yeah, hopefully most of our viewers are too young to understand these references right now. Go ask your parents.
I heard about 1940 Germany on a podcast. Oh, that's good.
Sure, that's good. 1936, but
next week we'll talk about the Vietnam War. How about that?
I'm gonna stop coming on this thing.
Born in the USA. Anyway, so. Big, big thanks to both Sean and Justin for coming on tonight. Appreciate you guys, as always. Be sure to check us out every week over on MTG Cast and also on the YouTubes now. All of our video podcasts will be uploaded to there, so check those out. And don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe and all the other things you can do on a YouTube channel. Be sure to check us out on Facebook and on Twitter and email us at eotnews@gmail.com. And next week, we're going to talk about more... stuff, including the robot Nicol Bolas. Fingers crossed on that one. So, since Steven's not here, does anybody else want to say our tagline as we sign off for the night?
Something, something, do it again.
I guess it's close enough. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you all next week.